The 2000 AD Thrillcast Supplemental, Barry Tomlinson, Part 1. Barry Tomlinson may not be one of the names that springs immediately to the forefront of histories of 2000 AD, but his influence on British comics for 30 years cannot be understated. While Barry worked at IPC, he was probably one of the most successful editors of his time. He turned venerable staple Tiger into an all-sports comic before taking the hugely popular Roy the Rover's character and spinning him off into his own title in 1975. It was Barry's ability to secure celebrity endorsements for his comics and getting sports people and celebrities to write for the titles that created a huge success. Roy the Rover's launched with over 300,000 sales and... we all know that Roy the Rover's has become a national institution. He relaunched his childhood favourite Eagle in 1982, which lasted more than a decade. He was group editor for Battle and 2000 AD, where his soft touch with the latter allowed Steve McManus and Richard Burton to guide the comic to the great heights of its 1980s heyday. He created the horror comic Scream, which we discussed with Ian Rimmer earlier this year. And he went on to create or edit countless other comics, such as Speed, Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles, Mask, Ring Raiders, and many more. And then went on to create and write the Scorer comic strip in the Daily Mail newspaper, which ran for an incredible 22 years. In a two-part interview, we talked to Barry about his work in comics, his unique and insanely successful approach to marketing and celebrity endorsement, and the rise and rise of Roy Race of Melchester Rovers. So, you were group editor of the group of comics that included 2000 AD in its kind of heyday under Steve McManus. We'll talk a bit about 2000 AD a bit further on, but I kind of wanted to give people an idea of just how embedded you are in the history of British comics. Because I mean, you started way back in the early 60s, didn't you?
1961, when I first joined Fleetway Publication.
And how did you come to work? Had you already wanted to work in comic books?
No, I'd never thought about it before. Someone showed me an advert which said beginners wanted for children's comics.
Oh, right, okay.
And I thought, well, that sounds jolly. I tried to get various jobs before that without any great success. So I applied for this job. I was interviewed by the managing editor, Alf Wallace, and offered a job as assistant to the script editor.
And what kind of thing did that entail? What was your day-to-day work as you know, the fresh face in the office?
Well, Ken Minnell was the script editor. He was a veteran of World War II, and he was a man who was absolutely full of ideas. So he would talk to the various scriptwriters, talk over ideas with them, ideas for new storylines. And I listened in to his conversations, and I learned an awful lot about how to produce good storylines for comics.
Okay. Because when I've been reading stuff that you've written about the time, you mention line editor Bernard Smith, and he had an editorial system which you say you've stuck with ever since. Do you want to sort of expand on what that system for producing good comics is?
Well, his system was much more of a clerical system of how to keep a very detailed book about where each script got to, where each storyline was, when the artwork arrived and when it was sent out. And it was such a good system that you knew exactly where you were at any given time. I mean, after my time working in the script department, they decided to transfer me onto a comic, and Lion was the first comic I went on to, and worked with Bernard Smith, who'd launched Lion, and he taught me the system of how to deal with script writers, how to deal with artwork, how to check various things, and always to keep a very comprehensive system.
Mm. Okay. And I imagine the kind of personalities in an office like that, where everybody's still in house, were very different to how they were today. How did you find it coming into, as somebody who hadn't necessarily wanted to work in comics, but read comics? How did you find fitting into this little world?
I seem to fit into it very well. Of course, all the contributors were freelance. Mm. It was only the staff people there. My first editorial job was online, which is in a great big office, which we shared with Tiger. So at one end of the office was the Tiger people, at the other end, the Lion people. And in the middle was a gentleman called Reg Clark, who was the sports editor. So I learned a lot from all those people by listening in, watching, and being part of it.
Okay. Because, I mean, Lion, even by then, was quite a venerable institution, was it? It had been around for a number of years.
Yes, 1952, I think it was, that Lion was launched. Mm. And shortly after I started working on Lion, Bernard Smith was moved on, and David Gregory took over as editor of Lion and also editor of Tiger. And he brought lots of new ideas into the comic and started to update it.
And I think you referenced David talking about being an editor as editing with a capital E, that actually, you know, it is the editor's job to kind of imprint their ideas and to a certain extent their personality on their publications.
Yes, very much so. Bernard Smith had taught me the basic system, and David Gregory taught me the style of being an editor. Mm. How to use your expenses, for example.
Well, use them creatively, perhaps.
Yes, creatively. How to be creative, not only in the publication, but elsewhere as well.
And tell us a little bit about the relationship between freelancers at the time and in-house staff, because obviously everything's done pretty much all over email now, and you know, FTPs, and we very rarely get any creators into the office at 2000 AD. But tell us a little bit about the kind of relationships that you built up over the time there.
Well, it was wonderful to meet some of the legends of children's comics, people like Frank Pepper, who had written Rockfish Rogan, who had launched the Roy the Rover story, and Captain Condor in Lion. Frank Pepper was, as I say, a legend, and it was great to sit and talk to him and to learn really all about writing for children's comics.
Mm. What were the key ingredients? What were the key ingredients for children's comics in the 1960s? Because looking back, a lot of them seem on some publications seem formulaic.
Yes, I mean, take Roy the Rover's story as an example. In the early days, Roy's team won every match that they played. In episode one, Roy would say, well, I think we'll win the FA Cup this year, lads. Let's go for it. And you knew full well that in the last instalment, they would win the FA Cup. But I gradually introduced things into that storyline where Rovers lost matches as well as winning them. And Roy had a life away from the football pitch.
Coming back to Bernard Smith, the old Lion editor, I mean, he lived to be 104. And there's a wonderful quip in something you've written where he comments about how he was costing the company pension scheme a fortune.
Yes. Bernard lived in St Albans, and at that time I also lived in St Albans, so I often travelled with him. And he was a very modest man. After he retired, he never came back to the office. I invited him to so many functions, but he always declined, saying people don't want to see me. But he was a legend as an editor, and he was the man, in fact, who thought up the name Roy of the Rovers. And not many people know that until they read my book.
There's also this wonderful moment where I think you mention some of the art agency people who obviously the artists work with, bringing in the artwork, and the first thing Bernard did was to whip out a ruler to make sure it was the right size to be reduced down, which you know, the idea that he had to check every time is amazing.
that was an absolute tradition with him. Mm-hmm. As the artwork arrived on his desk, the ruler would come out, slapped on the artwork. Once he was decided that it was the right size, then things would move on from there, and he'd look at the artwork and work on it. But the size was the most important thing.
Well, what happened to it if it wasn't the right size?
It always was. I think Bernard had got everybody very well trained. Most of the artwork came in twice the size it appears in the comic. Mm. And they were very large pieces of artwork to deal with.
Talk a bit about David Gregory, because you said he had a lot of ideas coming in. How did he change things at Lion and Tiger?
In Lion particularly, he dropped some of the older stories and brought in new adventures and new characters. He worked closely with a gentleman called Jeffrey Kemp, and the two of them updated Lion. And it was around about that time, as they started to do that, that I moved from Lion onto Tiger.
Describe these two comics, because I think many of the people listening now might not necessarily know what were kind of staples of British comics at the time. What were the ethoses of Lion and Tiger at the time?
Tiger was a sport and adventure title. It had some adventure stories in it, but it was mainly sport, whereas Lion was just straight adventure. Stories like Captain Condor, the space hero, Paddy Payne, Warrior of the Skies, a fighter pilot, Robot Archie, that's another famous story, about the Mechanical Man, which is a bit early for those sort of things, but he was a very basic robot, but very popular with the readership.
In terms of their popularity, I mean, what kind of numbers are we talking about in terms of sales in the 60s?
They were probably doing 350,000 to 400,000 copies a week.
Wow, that's incredible.
It pretty good circulation. I wouldn't mind having that circulation throughout my time in the comics.
In terms of Fleetway as an organisation, where did this kind of team sit? Were you squirreled away somewhere, or were you just another part of this huge publishing operation?
Well, it was a huge publishing operation. There'd be a little room with four people in, the editor, the sub-editor, and two art people. Normally four people per title. So it was a very tightly knit group of people that produced the comics, with everybody else, of course, being freelance.
And I mean, all the way through your writing, you mentioned these Fleetway executives who would stick their oar in occasionally, and we'll come on to talk about when they've done that in a bit. Was it a very kind of old school kind of corporate structure where it was kind of because I've heard stories from John Wagner and various other people who worked, say, for example, DC Thompson, the main competitors for Fleetway, about how old-fashioned and stuffy the structures of these companies could be. Was it the same at Fleetway?
It was, really. I mean, in those days, I can remember walking down the corridor with one of the sub-editors who had very long hair, and one of the executives called out to him, "I think it's time you had a haircut." It was rather like being in the army. I think a lot of them were ex-army types.
Mm, mm. Oh, you did national service, didn't you?
I did indeed, yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about that, because you had a strange little publishing empire of your own while you were doing your service, didn't you?
That's why I first became interested in journalism. One of the soldiers at the barracks in Germany had a trombone, and he practiced on the trombone day and night, and it got on everybody's nerves a bit. So I decided to form an organisation called the Anti-Trombone League. And I bought out a magazine, the Anti-Trombone League magazine, which was very, very popular with the soldiers at the time. And this was the first time I've ever done anything editorially, but it proved to be very popular. And I then decided to bring in some of the well-known show business people at the time to contribute to the magazine. And we got Styx, who was one of the top cartoonists at the time, to draw for us. and people like Petunia Clark to join in, organise competitions for the magazine and write for the magazine. And that was my first taste of getting famous people to get involved with my titles. And it was a tradition I always followed.
Yeah, I mean, this is something we'll keep coming back to over the course of this. But I mean, how many copies of this Anti-Trombone League were you distributing?
Well, it's only probably about a couple of hundred at the most. What I would do, I would creep into the commanding officers department and use their Gestetner printing machine to print the magazine and use their paper and their ink. And no one ever told me off for doing this. I think I was lucky to get away with it.
I presume it was like, you know, humorous articles and jokes and things like that about the kind of ridiculousness of this fellow's trombone playing.
That was part of it. It was also the latest news about what was going on in the regiment at the time.
Was there a connection with Peter Sellers as well, I think?
Yes, Peter Sellers eventually joined the Anti-Trombone League. That was just after I finished my national service, because I carried on with the Anti-Trombone League. Then we got lots more famous people to join. Mm. And Peter Sellers was probably as famous as anybody. And I can remember meeting him for the first time because I was always an enormous fan of his. Mm. And Audio Magazine asked me to do an interview with him. So I was delighted to meet him and have my photograph taken, showing him a copy of Tiger, which I was editing at the time.
Right. Tell us about some of the telegrams you exchanged with Peter Sellers. I mean, that's an incredible thing to just have somebody. I mean, he was at the height of his fame and his power at that period. Tell us a bit about the exchange of telegrams you had with him.
Yes, well, when some funny incident happened, I would often send him a telegram with some humorous stuff in it, and he would promptly reply, no matter where he was. Sometimes he was in Switzerland or anywhere in the world. And he would reply in very humorous terms and tell me some hilarious story of what was going on there at the time. So it was a great privilege and pleasure to work so closely with him. And we eventually brought other celebrities into it, people like Jimmy Edwards and Ted Ray and Roy Castle, Alma Cogan, all the top names at that time.
I mean, like I said, I mean, that's incredible for what is essentially just a small regimental magazine, self-produced, without any kind of authorization from the higher ups. Did it require a significant amount of kind of chutzpah on your part? Was this kind of second nature, just go, oh, I'm just going to get in touch with Peter Sellers to see if he'll be interested in joining the Anti-Trombone League?
Yes, that's how I was thinking. I was very innocent in those days, I think. I just thought I could do it. And once I found out I could do it, I followed that tradition throughout my career.
Well, let's fast forward to Tiger, which there was a very specific reason why you were brought on to Tiger, wasn't there?
Yes, there was a spelling mistake on the front cover. And David Gregory was rather upset by that, so he immediately transferred me from Lion onto Tiger, said, the job's yours, but make sure it doesn't happen again. And I don't think it did, actually. I can remember once, many, many, many years later, I left the price off. I did a very spectacular design for a Tiger front cover, but I forgot to put the price onto it. I think they printed a few thousand before someone spotted it.
I remember
John Sanders, who was the editorial director at the time, calling me into his office and making it clear he wasn't pleased about that. But he said to me, you're allowed one mistake in your life and you've just made it.
Well, I guess as motivating factors go, that's probably quite a strong one.
It didn't happen again.
So, I mean, Tiger had been going since 1954, and as you say, it was a sports and adventure title. When you said when David Gregory came in, he had lots of different ideas. what was the impact of both him and you on Tiger? Or was it like, as you mentioned earlier, kind of, you know, sweeping away kind of the dead wood, or did you bring a completely different ethos to the publication?
We were very lucky at that time because Tiger switched from letterpress printing, which looked very cheap, to the more sophisticated offset printed. And I mean, it meant that we could use colour photographs, for example. Mm. So I was very keen on introducing very large photographs of sporting stars into Tiger because I felt that children were interested in collecting pictures of their favourite people. So we introduced a big picture policy, which worked very well.
And when you say moving from letterpress to web offset, for those who don't know what that means, we're essentially talking about old school printing presses versus a more technically advanced modern style presses, aren't we?
Yes, with glossy paper and more colour and the ability to reproduce photographs very clearly.
Was this something that everyone took advantage of, or was it something that you saw a niche, you saw an opportunity to sort of expand into this kind of full colour photography?
At that time, quite a few of the comics were switched to offset. I remember going on a offset course down on the south coast and learning all about it and learning the basic thing that oil and water don't mix,
right,
which is a very important thing, it seems, in offset printing.
Well,
so it was around about this time that David Gregory was asked to produce a football magazine, which was Shoot, and he moved off Tiger to edit Shoot. And very fortunately, he recommended me to take over as editor of Tiger, which I did. And that was really a turning point in my career, that to take over a comic such as Tiger. And I converted it into an all-sports title. I dropped all the adventure stories and made it totally sport, which was a big jump for it. But that seemed to be a popular idea because sport was very popular with children.
What was the motivating factor behind you doing that?
Well, I thought that Lion was there as an adventure title. So it was important, I thought, that Tiger should have much more its own identity and become a sports title. And I also wanted to introduce some real-life sports people into Tiger to make it a combination of real-life features and picture stories.
Okay. Oh, tell us a little about this, a little bit about your transition to editor, because not everyone is editor material, and there've been a few occasions that I've read of where you know, in the dim and distant past, when people have stepped up to the editor's chair and they've either put some people's noses out of joint, or they've not been able to kind of slide into the role properly. Did you find much friction when you took over from David, or had you already kind of put the groundwork in?
Well, I think I put the groundwork in. I think the management at the time had two or three other people in mind to edit it. But as I say, I was very fortunate that David Gregory suggested me. I think maybe he thought it was an insurance policy that should Shoot not be successful, he could always come back again. But yes, I'm probably as editor and group editor. I did put quite a few people's noses out of joint at various times. But I seemed to fit into the editor's job okay. And I found it easy and interesting, something I really enjoyed doing.
Aside from the obvious kind of, I don't know, mechanical, logistical aspects that you'd learned from Bernard Smith about having an editorial system, what's the key to being a good editor on a title like Tiger?
I think you've got to be in tune with the readership. You've got to know what the readership wants. So each time they wrote to us, we asked them to give their two favourite stories. So we were able to keep a close check on what was popular and what was not. And we could tell week by week if a story was growing in popularity or losing its appeal. And we could adjust the contents according to what the readers thought.
Because that's something that followed through well into 2000 AD, where you had the little box that you would cut out, you know, you'd list your favourite strips in order and send it in. I guess that there was much more interaction bizarrely, in an age of social media now, there seem to have been much more interaction between editorial and readers, in that readers would communicate directly with you. They would send you their thoughts quite often. I mean, were the mailbags bulging every week, or was it more selective?
We would get hundreds of letters each week. Right. When I launched Roy the Rovers as a separate title, the first thing I put into the new title was a recorded line where readers could telephone and leave their comments about the comic. And that proved to be so popular that the first weekend of Roy the Rovers appearing as a separate title, the phone lines got jammed and the recording machine got jammed, and I had to travel into London over the weekend to replenish the tapes so we could continue to get the readership comments. I think it was the first time we've ever been a phone-in, and right. The Roy the Rovers phone-in worked really well. Perhaps too well.
Well, that's incredible. I mean, what kind of things were these kids saying on this tape?
Well, we invited them to say anything they wanted, to talk about the stories in the comic or talk about real-life football. So they talked about anything at all. We had a big job. We had one of the sub-editors who had a big job each Monday morning to sit there and go through all the tapes.
I think that's just incredible, because to actually hear your readers' voices, you know, rather than just it being letters and whatever, to actually have, I mean, I don't know if you can remember whether there are any kids in particular who, I don't know, would talk for hours or you know, phone up regularly or anything like that.
Yes, there were regular ones, and also, as you say, other ones who would talk for a very long time and fill up too much of the tape. But it was important to listen to what they had to say. Mm. And it was another reason I was very keen to have visits to schools and have comic exhibitions where the readership could come to us. And we would show them how the comic was produced, and in return, they would tell us what they liked and what they didn't like. Mm. So that contact with the readership was very important, whether it was by phone or going to schools or having comic exhibitions.
Mm. Was there ever a time when you started to get feedback that a strip was unliked or not, perhaps not as popular, and you thought, well, actually, I disagree with them. I'm gonna keep publishing this one.
No, we always went by what the readership said. Mm. I can remember one of the stories in Tiger was called Skid Solo, which was a motor racing story, which was very well written by a gentleman called Fred Baker and illustrated by John Vernon. And I thought it was a tremendous story, but it started to go down on the popularity charts, and we watched it going down, and it carried on. And so I had to make a really very, very difficult decision to drop a story which I particularly liked and was a long-running Tiger story.
One of the things that you seem particularly passionate about was having your name as editor when you did your little editor's letter every week, that it would be signed off from, you know, Barry Tomlinson, rather than previously editorials have been signed off by the editor as a kind of faceless entity.
That's right.
Why was that so important?
I can remember when I read the original Eagle and Marcus Morris was editor, and he always signed it Marcus Morris, and his photograph quite often appeared in the publication, and I knew who the editor was, and I felt he was a friend of mine, and I thought it was important that the editor of all the publications should be identified by the readership, that they would know his name. Nobody looked like, which is why my photograph appeared quite often in Tiger, because readers knew there was someone there representing them, and it was a much better relationship between reader and editor if they knew who he was, what he looked like, and what he was doing.
I mean, I've got a couple of questions about this. There was some suspicion amongst your colleagues that you were being ambitious in this, that you were trying to get your name out there, that it was a personal thing rather than, as you say, connecting with the readers, wasn't it?
Yes, it was never about me. It was about the publication. If I could get publicity for the publication and I had to be visual in doing it, then I was quite happy to do that. But no, I was never ambitious for myself at all. despite what some people may think.
I mean, was that just a gossip thing, or was there some friction there?
I think some people thought it was I was publicity seeking for myself, but that certainly wasn't true. Sure. I mean, it didn't work because reading Steve McManus's book, The Mighty One,
yeah.
When he refers to me in his book, he refers to me as the tall, bespectacled group editor. So I haven't got a name, so obviously it didn't work too well, did it?
Wait, I think this is something that makes me very interested, because there became a tradition in British comics of having fictional editors. So you had Tharg the Mighty, you had Ghastly McNasty on Scream, you had the Big E, you had Max from the 13th Floor, who eventually became the editor of the main voice for the New Eagle. Why do you think it swung that way? That went for fictional editors rather than continuing this personal connection?
Well, all those titles you mentioned were titles in my group that I was involved in, having people like Garfield McNasty editing it. I think if you've got the right sort of publication, then it's great fun to have an editor like Garfield McNasty to front the publication. Of course, I think had you put Barry Tomlinson, for example, I don't think that name goes too well with Scream, but Garfield McNasty does. So if it's right, then by all means, have it. Someone like Ghastly McNasty or Tharg, of course, which works extraordinarily well.
Yeah, well, it's always one of the curious things about 2080s history, that throughout it all, through all the different changes and to a certain extent stylistic changes that have gone on, Tharg has endured it all, really.
Indeed. I mean, I can recall standing on the steps of 10 Downing Street and photographing the mighty Tharg standing next to the duty policeman outside number 10.
Let's briefly talk about that, because that is as I mentioned earlier, the kind of chutzpah of having Steve McManus dressed as Tharg the Mighty stood on Downing Street. What was the kernel of that idea?
Well, the main thing was to get publicity, get some photographs into the media, but he was there to offer his services to Margaret Thatcher. To help run the country, because he was running his own publication very well, so why shouldn't he help to run the country? But that was our plot, and it made a nice photograph.
with these publicity stunts, are they as much for the readers of the publication as they are for kind of wider publicity? Is it a way of just I don't know, giving the readers a good laugh, making them sort of see the title is relevant in a wider world?
Yeah, I think the Tharg one was done for publicity. Mm. I don't think it would have meant a great deal, perhaps, to the readership. But other ones where you get involved with real-life people, for example, when we asked Sir Ralph Ramsey to take over as manager of the Roy the Rovers team, that was done partly for publicity, but partly because the readership knew Alf Ramsey as the manager, the World Cup winning manager, and to see him brought into the story and mixing fact with fiction in that way, that worked really well, because children were becoming more sophisticated. Mm. They were watching television an awful lot, and they wanted to see the personalities of the day involved in their favourite publications.
I mean, the one thing that you did start doing once you'd brought Tiger to be an all sports publication was the Tiger Sports Star of the Year, where people voted for their favorite sports star. But you had a surprise winner for the first one, didn't you? Because the vote got split between everyone's favorite football teams.
Yes, it was a bit of a surprise there, because we thought a footballer would win it, but the football vote was hopelessly split, everybody voting for their favourite footballer and their favourite team. And it ended up that Ann Jones was the winner, a star of tennis, and table tennis, but she was a worthy winner, so I presented the trophy to her, and that went down okay with the readership. But in subsequent years, we actually nominated the people we thought deserved to be voted for. We'd nominate about 12 people, of which about three or four would be footballers. And it stopped the readers voting for their favourite team and voting for someone who really deserved to get the award. So the first winner was the England goalkeeper, Gordon Banks.
Whose hand you nearly broke on one occasion, I believe.
Yes, right. I presented the trophy to him, and afterwards he put it into a very stout wooden box, which protected the cup. And I got into the front of Gordon's car and swung the box to put it on the back seat, and hitting Gordon on the hand on the way. And I had this terrible nightmare that the headlines would say, Tiger editor breaks England goalkeeper's hand. Fortunately, I didn't. But talking to Gordon on that journey in the car, I said, what sort of things have you got going for you? Who are you writing for? And he was writing for nobody at all. So I said, would you like to write for Tiger? And he said, yes, he would. And he wrote for Tiger for many years, and it was an extremely popular feature. Mm-hmm. But there I was, I just signed up the England goalkeeper, and on the way back I had to think, well, how do I pay for this? So we dropped two pages of picture strip and put the Gordon article in place of it, and the price just about balanced out.
Right.
So that was the first of a long line of sports celebrities who wrote for Tiger.
Yeah, how did your freelancers feel about the two pages disappearing that they could potentially fill?
You're not supposed to ask questions like that. Well, we dropped the story, which was bottom of the popularity chart at the time, and it was one that would have been dropped anyway.
Mm. I mean, the Tiger Sports Star of the Year was seemed to get bigger and bigger every year. Like the presentations, the stars you were talking to, and as you brought new people on, I mean. We've talked about that ability you discovered to just invite people to do things, whether it was Peter Sellers back on the Anti Trombone League, or I mean you then had Eric Morecambe and Ernie Wise writing for you eventually. I mean they were superstars in the 70s.
Oh, they were absolutely massive. I can remember sitting there thinking, well, I've got all these big sporting names writing to Tiger. Why don't I get some show business people? When you look at show business at that time, Morecambe and Wise were clearly the most popular people. So I signed Eric Morecambe to write for Roy the Rovers comic because he's a great football fan.
Mm.
And Ernie wrote for Tiger. And after that, Ernie came to so many of our events that we held when we did Tiger Sports Star of the Year presentations. On many occasions, Ernie presented the trophy. He always came to our events and really seemed to enjoy it.
I mean, it's puzzling. I mean, how did you go about getting these people to do this?
Charm, of course. Charm. the first thing was that they had to know the publication, and Tiger and Roy the Rovers were so well known to people that inevitably when you spoke to someone and said, would you like to appear in one of those publications, they'd know the publications and you could appear. I can remember on one occasion after we signed Jeff Boycott to write for Tiger, I went along to Lord's Cricket Ground to meet him. And in those days, on non-match days, Lord's Cricket Ground was a fortress. You couldn't get in.
Mm.
But I went to the gate and I said, I've got an appointment with Geoffrey Boycott. They said, who are you from? I said, from IBC magazines. They said, no, you can't come in. And for about 20 minutes, I was arguing with him to be let in. They wouldn't let me in. So in desperation at the end, I said, well, get in touch with Geoffrey and say it's the editor of Tiger. And the gate man said, Tiger, why didn't you say so? Of course you can go in. That was the magic of Tiger at that time. It would get you in anywhere, whereas IPC magazine, the largest publishing company in Europe at that time, was kept out.
I mean, that speaks of a tremendous cultural impact of these comics.
It does, yes. I mean, Tiger always had that sort of reputation, and Roy the Rovers has, of course. And the great thing about Roy the Rovers is the name still means a great deal today, even after 60 years. Hence the book, Real Roy the Rover Stuff.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, we'll talk about Roy a bit more in depth in a minute. But I mean, you mentioned Jeff Boycott there, but the kind of stars that you had, I mean, you had Ian Botham, I've already mentioned Morecambe and Wise, Gordon Banks. This increasing sophistication of the readership, was that a double-edged sword, that as the children grew more aware of the world around them, of other opportunities for entertainment, that was a natural eroding of the ground that comics had always occupied?
That's what happened eventually. I mean, first of all, it was a very good thing. But eventually, as children got involved with computers and with the internet, the role of comics became less and less important. At one time, the most important thing in a child's life was the rattle of the letterbox once a week when the comic was delivered with the morning newspaper. Mm. And it was often a battle between the dad and the son, who was going to get to it first. But as children found other things to do, of course, then the role of comics became less important, and it's very clear looking at the circulation figures that they were steadily going down. Mm. And eventually, except for one or two titles, it just petered out.
Well, I find it interesting because Tiger merged into the New Eagle in 1985, and it had gone on to cheaper printing to try and stave things off. And there, as you say, there was a lot of competition starting to come into occupying children's time. I mean, 2000 AD in 1985 was still very much at its height. So there were comics that were bucking the trend. Had Tiger's kind of sports focus, had that just moved out of fashion?
I think sport was probably more popular, but children could see it in other ways. They could watch it live on television. And whereas our comics are always slightly out of date because of the 10-week publishing delay, they could watch things live as they happened on television. And I think that was more important to them. And no matter what we tried with a comic like Tiger to make it carry on, after so many years, we just lost out.
Yeah. How do you feel about that in hindsight? Because, you know, you'd poured so much into it. You'd changed the face of the comic. You brought all these amazing stars in. You'd nurtured this thing for so long, to then see it essentially, you know, receive a death by a thousand cuts over time. That must have been heartbreaking.
It was very sad. I mean, the fortunate thing though was that it merged into another of my titles. So in a sense, it still carried on in my little group. Mm. And the other good thing, of course, is that Roy the Rovers spun out of Tiger into his own publication. And he has survived after 60 years, and the name still means so much to so many people today.
Mm. Is he the kind of sole legacy of Tiger, or is there a wider impact that Tiger has had on British culture, and particularly British children?
Well, I hope it has, yes. Yeah. I mean, Roy the Rovers is the sort of example of what can happen to a character. But there were still other very good characters that appeared in Tiger, who I hope people still remember. At least I know they do still remember, because I still get lots of communication from people talking about those characters, not only Roy the Rovers, but other characters as well.
Well, I mean, let's talk a bit more about Roy, because, I mean, he'd been around for 21 years before he got his own title in 76. And other comics like Scorcher and Top Soccer, they didn't survive, but Roy did. Why do you think that is?
I think because he'd been appearing for so many years, we had a chance to build up the character. And I think the decision I made to make Roy much more a true-life character, whereby the team would lose matches as well as win them, and to give Roy a life away from the football pitch. He became the first boys' comic hero to get married and to become a father. Mm. And although those events were good for publicity. They attracted people's attention to the publication. And I think they increased the circulation because people were buying them really just to see what was happening.
So it was much more of a... I think you told the Duke of Edinburgh that it was a soap opera.
But he told me.
All right.
We were very fortunate that the Duke wrote for the first issue of Roy the Rovers. I wanted to get something quite spectacular in the first issue. And so I wrote to Buckingham Palace and asked him if he would write for us. And he agreed to do so.
Good God. I mean, was he a big football fan?
I don't think he's a particular football fan. He used to go to the odd cup final.
Yeah.
But I think he liked cricket more than football.
Right.
Once again, I'm quoting from Steve McManus's book. It said there was speculation at the time that my ambition was to be in the New Year's Honours list because I signed the Duke to write. But he says, such a dream was never mentioned to me, said Steve. And it wasn't mentioned to me either. But what a good idea.
Well, I mean, Morecambe and Wise are one thing, but getting royalty to pen a piece for the first issue of a football comic, I mean... Even by the standards of what you were doing at the time, that's an extraordinary piece of good fortune.
It was. I think there was a slight doubt at one time, but when I explained that it was a spin-off from Tiger, and it would have the same traditions as Tiger, and I think that got us the okay in the end of the day.
Was there still a sense of comics being wholesome, a good diversion for kids?
Yes, I think it was important that a comic would have a good reputation, not only with the media, but with the parents. Something like Tiger and Roy the Rovers were very much a parent buy. And I think most of my publications were enthusiastically received by the parents. And one of the great secrets of being successful with a comic is to make sure that dad reads it as well as the boy.
When we come on to talk a bit more in depth about 2000 AD, that will be an interesting thing to discuss more. But just on Roy the Rovers, I mean, football's a legendarily tribal world where you have your favourite team and you know you support it through the highs and the lows. How could a character like Roy be a unifying character in such a divided world?
Well, Roy played for Melchester Rovers, and Melchester is your local team. No matter where you live, it's your local team. If you live in Plymouth, it's just round the corner from you. If you live in Sheffield, it's just down the road. So Melchester belonged to everybody. So we didn't get caught up in that sort of tribal warfare that you mentioned. Roy was universal, and he was everybody's favourite because we didn't tie him down to a particular area of the country.
And you said that you began to introduce the notion that Melchester could actually lose a game as an input of drama into the whole thing. How much influence as editor did you have over scripts? Did you give mandates or did you give just a general idea of where you wanted things to go?
I would have a meeting every few weeks with the author. Most of the time that I was editing, it was Tom Tully writing the Roy the Rover story. And we'd meet up probably every 4 or 5 weeks and sit down for a couple of hours, talk about the plot on the pitch and the plot off the pitch. Then combine the two, then go away and have a very nice lunch. Tom would have a cigar, travel back to Reading where he lived, and we'd have another 6 weeks of good Roy stories.
Tom Tully's a name that 2000 AD readers of yore will remember. Why was he a good Roy the Rovers writer?
Well, he was a good writer for no matter what story he tackled. If you were launching a new story, the first person you'd look at really would be Tom Tully to write the story, because he had the ability of creating a story, creating situations which went down very well with the readership, and his stories were always popular. So Tom was a natural to do the Roy the Rover story.
Why do you think Roy has become, well, has been so popular for so long? I mean, as you say, you know, he's entered the lexicon. You know, a real Roy the Rover story is part of the English language in the same way that you know, talking about Judge Dredd is you know, an analogy for heavy-handed policing. Why do you think Roy in particular survived where so many fell away, and he went on to become, like Dan Dare, like Judge Dredd, one of those all-time great characters?
For the sheer number of years that he appeared, a boy would read it, he'd grow up, and his son would read it, and he would grow up, and eventually he had generations of the same family all reading the same comic. So I think that also happened, you know, within families, and it happened with the media, that the media grew up with Roy the Rover, so it became a character that everybody knew and still knows, in fact.
Do you think there's with Roy, there's a certain amount of that kind of old school grassroots football feel to it, that you know, that notion that any young lad from you know, a council estate or a back street in any town could go on to be that big next football star, but not necessarily lose a connection with the community he grew up in?
I think it's a traditional story, Roy the Rovers, but it doesn't mean to say that if it came back now, it couldn't be updated in a way which would be popular with 2016 football fans.
Yeah.
So I think it's an ageless character that could fit into any time.
Okay. I mean, why he finished in around, I think it was 1995, the comic ended. Why do you think that was? Was it just the same kind of competition for youngsters' attention?
It probably stopped because I wasn't involved with it anymore. I mean, somebody somewhere made the great decision that Roy would get involved in a helicopter crash and lose his left foot in the accident, and that seems to me probably not the best idea in the history of children's comics. If you've got a hero, you don't take his foot away, particularly his left foot, which is his scoring foot. And to me, that was a very strange decision, because once that had been done, what can you do with the character?
I mean, with it's the perennial age-old problem of long-running characters. Is that when you do end up getting generations of families who've read the same character, it's how do you maintain the drama? How do you keep them going when they appear ageless, when nothing necessarily ever really changes? I guess that was just a slightly, pardon the expression, clod-footed attempt to move things on. I mean, do you think with Roy, he should just remain evergreen?
I think so. I mean, there were attempts made after my time to update the storyline to bring in Roy's son. And all sorts of ingredients were put into the story which we would never have entertained in those old days. And I think when you try and change the character of the story, it just loses out. And things they introduced, like drinking and drugs and all sorts of extra things, and it just didn't fit in with the Roy story, and I'm afraid it just faded away, really. That's not to say he can't come back again, of course.
Sure. I mean, how did you deal with things like, I mean, you know, no child was immune from seeing the soccer hooliganism of the 1980s and disasters like Hillsborough and things like that. How did you as editorial deal with issues like that?
Roy had very strong views. He would lecture against hooliganism in football, and he would lecture about all sorts of things. And eventually the Football Association was so pleased at what he was saying that they joined him in various campaigns, which I'm sure had some influence on children. He was very keen on all-seater stadiums, for example. The Melchester Stadium was one of the first ones to have that. And various other campaigns which the FA joined with Roy, and that worked very well.
Yeah. I guess for them, when you have that way into, you know, children's homes through the comic, then it's incredibly useful for communicating ideas like that.
Yeah, it's great privilege to have that way of getting involved with children. But as I say, if you tied it in with parents as well, get the parents on your side, that was an important thing to do, I think.
One of the things that you obviously, you've already very well known for bringing in sports stars, and Roy of the Rovers was no exception to this. But in where you're merging photographs with photographs of real people and inserting Roy, then somebody always had to play Roy, and you were Roy on quite a few occasions, weren't you?
I had the great privilege of doing that. Mm. I had to breathe in all the time, of course, and expand my chest as much as possible. And I posed with various celebrities and various people at various times, but once the photograph was taken, the artist would draw the face and Roy's face would appear instead of mine. That was in the days, of course, before computers could be used to do that sort of thing. It was all done by hand and with a bit of glue and a bit of cutting out.
A big thank you to Barry for talking to us there. He and we will be back in 2 weeks' time for more about the heyday of the British comics industry, the decline and fall of Roy the Rovers, relaunching Eagle and overseeing 2000 AD. In the meantime, a very Merry Christmas from everyone at 2000 AD to you, our listeners. Splendig Verthrig.